Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Wonderful humans, welcome to episode 15 of Shifting the Paradigm. I'm Christina Gomez, your hostess for this next hour of adventure and UFO shenanigans, where we look and think outside the proverbial box, jump down rabbit holes, and where the red pill is actually a red Tic Tac. If you haven't had your paradigm shifted, get ready. Today, I am honored and excited to be interviewing a giant in the research field of UFOs and related phenomena, someone who, in my opinion, has contributed vast amounts of hard currency in investigative data via his books, his articles, and his presence in TV shows and his YouTube channel. Mr. Preston Dennett has been writing on the topic for almost 35 years since his first published article entitled On Magic and Monsters in 1986. Since then, he has written well over 100 published articles and 27 books. Welcome to Shifting the Paradigm, Mr. Preston Dennett.
Thanks, Christina. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. And Preston, I have a lot of subscribers who are in my age bracket being Gen Zs, and many of whom are just recently being exposed to this topic. Thanks in main part to the increased coverage that UFOs are being given in the mainstream media online and legacy media. So I really want to familiarize them with your long history of investigating the topic. So we will cover questions involving some of your books, written articles, and videos on your channel. But Preston, right off the bat, before we get into your research in history of investigating this UFO topic, I want to ask you about your thoughts on the 180-day Pentagon UFO report that was released to the public on July 25th.
I'm happy about it in some ways. I mean, it is movement. Our government has really refused to even discuss UFOs in any way for decades, and have always said there's absolutely nothing to this. Basically, shut up, you're bothering me. So I'm happy about that. They have said, well, maybe there's something to us, and it deserves further study. And that's a 180 degree turnaround. So it's a tiny step forward for all humankind. But on the other hand, I am so disappointed. It's just filled with lies. It really is. Here they are saying, well, we have started studying this. I'm like, no, you have been studying this for like 70 or 80 years. They're talking about sightings. I'm like, really, just sightings? What about all the UFO landing cases? What about the people who are being taken on board? What about the Roswell UFO crash? Tell us about that. So for them to call this like balloons or airborne clutter or possibly Chinese or Russian technology or even our own technology. I'm like, what? Our own? You're the Pentagon. You don't know your own technology? So it's filled with doublespeak and lies. I honestly don't think we're going to get disclosure from our government, certainly not voluntarily. Feel like they're being dragged into this kicking and screaming and are still lying. Lies, lies, lies. It's pretty unfortunate.
And given your length of time being involved in researching this topic and seeing the way that it has become more mainstream and serious coverage, in your opinion, do you think that some progressive group within the Department of Defense will at some point in the near future give us proper disclosure?
I do think that there are people within this group that's covering it up, which is, I think, the military-industrial complex. The very high levels of the military, that yes, some of these are good people who are striving really hard to get this information out there, because it's something I think that all humanity deserves to know. And I think disclosure is something that has to move forward, because the cat is out of the bag. There are hundreds of whistleblowers who have already stepped forward. There's no way you can hide the truth on this forever. I mean, it's like trying to hide the sky. You can't do it. There's no way. At some point, we will have disclosure. And I think, it may come not from the U.S., maybe from whistleblower type people within the government, or perhaps from another country, or maybe even ultimately from the ETs themselves, because they have the power to do it. And they just might show themselves in a way that it would be indisputable to everyone. That would be amazing.
So in your opinion, which one do you think it would be that would give the disclosure?
I think it's going to be the ETs. because I'm a little jaded. You know, I've been in this field for such a long time. And back in the late 1980s, when I got involved in this field, there was rumors of disclosure, and it didn't happen. And every 5 years or so, they'd be like, oh, it's going to happen this year. Nope, never happened. I mean, I got involved in this field when I was, 21 years old, a young man. And I was pretty excited, pretty optimistic about it. But now, having heard so many lies, I mean, there's a concerted cover-up. This is no joke. The cover-up is absolutely real. It's proven. We can prove this through documents released from the Freedom of Information Act. And we know for a fact that our government is very, very interested in this, that this is a top secret subject, that virtually every intelligence agency within the U.S. government, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, all of them take this subject very seriously. So I don't know. I just don't trust them anymore.
Who does? It's really hard, especially in this point in time. Now, you have written a ton of books with titles such as One in 40, The UFO Epidemic, and Onboard UFO Encounters, and even dealing with the paranormal with the book Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles. Out of all the books you've written, which would you say was a game changer for you because of the conclusions you came to, and why?
I would say actually it's my first book, UFO Healings, which I've since reissued as a much larger book called The Healing Power of UFOs. And this was the first book of its kind to present cases in which people have been healed, physically healed, as a result of a UFO encounter. And by that I mean perhaps people are struck by a beam of light from a UFO, or visited in their bedroom by ETs, or actually taken on board, and they are healed of all kinds of injuries, illnesses, conditions, everything from colds to cancer. I mean, minor conditions like backaches or colds and flus to serious conditions such as diabetes, diphtheria, and AIDS. There's 30 cases of people healed of cancer, hepatitis, liver disease, heart disease, kidney stones. You name it, jaundice. There is just this incredible list of cases which present really good, hard evidence for UFO reality. And why I think it's a game changer is because there's a lot of fear surrounding this subject. This is something I think the government has really put forth, that this is a threat, which is absurd. These guys have been around, the ETs have been around for millennia. Thousands of years. They are very, very technologically advanced, spiritually advanced. If they wanted to take over, They could do it in a heartbeat. And we're not seeing that. And these healing cases are just one reason why I'm very encouraged about these ETs and their agenda on our planet. I can tell you conclusively, based on actual cases, that healing humanity is one of their primary agendas. So this is good news for us. These ETs are not here to hurt us. They're here to help us, guide us, teach us. They're not going to take over and solve all our problems. As any parent knows, you can't do that for your children. They have to learn on their own. So I think that's why we haven't seen sort of them taking over and doing everything for us, because that's not going to help us. But yeah, I am very encouraged about why they're here.
Well, there are quite a few cases of some abductions that are incredibly traumatic or even painful, but the ones that you're talking about, you're saying that these entities were healing people. Why do you think there's a difference? And why do you think these entities are healing us while maybe some others are being more traumatic towards humanity?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I've looked into this. And what I've found is that there is, in fact, a bell curve of behavior among the ETs, very much like humans. You know, some are good, some are bad. Some people do have traumatic encounters. I don't deny that for a second. I've covered many of them in my books. It's not always, you know, puppies and rainbows when you are taken on board a UFO. It can be very scary. But what I have noticed is that the ETs behave in ways that we would do. Their behavior falls under the same umbrella as human behavior, but by and large, it's far more benevolent. We are an extremely hostile species. We murder and kill each other and do all kinds of awful things. And we don't see that when people are taken on board. I don't see accounts of what I would call sadism or torture. That's extremely rare. So there are some negative cases, and when you look at the negative cases, what you see is that there's a lot of fear-based thinking going on. When someone has an encounter and is pulled on board and are physically examined, this can be absolutely terrifying. And for many people, this feels absolutely involuntary. They are being kidnapped against their will, undressed, physically examined by bug-like creatures. Of course, they're going to interpret this as a negative experience. But I've talked to people who've had the same experience, these same exact details, and do not have a strong fear reaction. And they have a completely different interpretation. And often what happens is when a person particularly is having repeated extensive encounters, it can start out very scary. And they will interpret this as a negative event. But as they get over their fear, as they begin to examine what is actually happening to them in an objective way, because fear will color your perception. It's very
absolutely.
Different. You know what I mean? Fear can sort of mess with your mind a little bit. So you, people who sort of move through that start to realize like, hey, this might not be so bad for me. And I've looked deeply into this. Again, I'm not going to say they're all our space brothers and this is happy fun, because it's not. But when someone does have an onboard encounter, they're physically examined, right? That's the most common thing people describe. And that is often scary. I mean, I can only imagine what it must be like to see a non-human being physically examining you. I don't like going to the doctor anyway. So
me neither.
who does? I mean, it's kind of something we do because we know it's good for us. And I think that's what's happening when people are being physically examined by ETs. Often they are being healed. And when someone doesn't have a strong fear reaction, this is where the good stuff happens. And this is what truly happens when someone's taken on board. They are not only physically examined, they are taken to the engine room. No kidding. They are taken to the engine room and shown how this craft works. Told in great detail, even. They are explained how these engines work. They were often taken to the helm, the control room, you know, where the pilot sits, sat in the chair and told how this craft works.
That's kind of exciting.
it's really cool. And it's not rare. this turns up over and over and over again.
So do you think that there is more than one race, like several races visiting us, or just one?
I think there are several. In fact, probably, I don't want to say infinite, but it sure seems like it. I will say that by and large, most people who I speak with describe some variation of what we know as the grays. You know, they're short, 4 to 5 feet tall, sometimes 3 foot, sometimes 6 foot, but somewhere within that range, usually 4 to 5 feet. Large, dark eyes, very pale skin, huge heads, no hair, wearing jumpsuits. This is the grays. But there's quite a variation among them. So I'm not so sure they're all the same species, so to speak. I mean, look at the variation among humans.
Yeah.
Right? We look very different. So that could be what we're seeing here. But it's not just grays. I would say the main types are grays, praying mantis, which is really strange to me. I'm like, really? Praying mantis? Bugs? Why that? I mean, there's so many different creatures on Earth. But this is what people are reporting. We're kind of stuck with the facts. This is what the cases are showing us. It's praying mantis, grays, and human looking. Outright human. They look just like us, though are often described as being very muscular, very beautiful, very strong, almost genetically perfect, but all different races as well. And beyond that, there's a category I would call strange humanoids. And by that I mean glowing light beings, short hairy dwarfs, tall 10 foot, 9 foot, 10 foot tall humanoid beings that are clearly not human.
Yeah, absolutely. And, but, you know, some people have said that they feel like the grays are kind of like artificial or robotic in nature, possibly drones. What do you feel about that when it comes to the grays?
Some definitely are. I've gotten enough reports of these. I'm going to point towards the 3 foot tall variety. Because people see him moving in lockstep. They don't seem to be emotional at all. And in fact, some people have been taken on board and seen them stacked up like, you know, cordwood or something. Turned
really?
Off. Yeah, turned off. So I think these are what we would call androids, biological robots, not beings with souls, so to speak. But most of the grays, no, they are. I have talked to people, and I'm not joking here, Christina. People have told me that these grays that they met were very emotional, very loving. And in fact, they felt more love coming from these grays than they have felt. Like, it was like holding their kid for the first time or getting, you know, the first
grays.
Time. They, yes. Very loving. And I think what's going on here is, you know, this is part of the cover-up. There's been a very concerted campaign to make UFO witnesses look like idiots. A person who sees a UFO, according to the Air Force, this is their policy, official policy. You did not see a UFO or an alien. You are on drugs, you are lying, you're hallucinating, or you are misperceiving. Those are the options, which is absolutely disingenuous because they know that this is real. And there's a very strong fear element here. They're pushing the fear element to this, and it's unwarranted. And the media latches onto it. The media itself is very fear-based. Humans are fear-based. We're taught to fear.
Well, it's survival of the fittest, right?
Yeah, well, this is sort of the thing. But the universe ultimately is a safe place. I mean, if you look into it, we are immortal beings. The very worst thing that can happen is we die. But we don't die. We just shed the physical body and move on to the astral body and come back if we have to. So the universe is ultimately safe, and fear is a trick. It's a lie. Don't buy into the fear. It's not real. What's real is love and truth. And that's one of the main ET agendas. They are trying very, very hard to wake people up to their own spirituality, their own spiritual abilities. This is absolutely a rule. People who are having encounters come away from it spiritually transformed to a huge degree. They become very psychic. They become interested in channeling or psychic reading or hands-on healing. They start having out-of-body experiences. They learn about past lives. I mean, I can go down the list. I've just uncovered a bunch of cases where people who have had encounters, this is so strange, have physically levitated, have learned how to physically levitate following their encounters. This is something that has absolutely been proven in a laboratory setting, human levitation. It is real. It's a real phenomenon. It's occurred in all cultures. There are cases, hundreds of cases stretching back over 2,000 years. It's a real
thing.
And
he wrote a whole book on it as well called Human Levitation. And he also featured it on a video you did for your channel about this phenomenon. So could you give us like an overview of your research into it and what you think might be behind such instances?
Yeah. I started to look into all aspects of the paranormal because there is a connection here to UFOs. And human levitation is one area of, you know, what I would call superhuman ability. It's not. It's a natural human ability that will manifest along the pathway to spiritual evolution at some point. And what we see, if you just look at the various cultures, is that the people who are levitating are often people of a very strong spiritual bent. You know, people who are like monks and nuns. The Flying Nun was a TV show, and it's kind of, I don't want to say reality-based, but in a way it is, because there are a lot of cases of flying nuns, and this is in every culture. Native American medicine men, African sorcerers, Tibetan monks or yogis. These are the type of people who are physically levitating. Young children. There's a bunch of cases involving little kids who have levitated. I included a whole chapter on that because this is definitely a thing where kids between the age of about 5 to 12 will spontaneously levitate, some, several times. So levitation is absolutely a real phenomena. It has been proven, as I said, in a laboratory setting.
Is there any video footage of this? Like, are we likely to see someone do this on live TV at some point?
Yeah, there is video footage. Sometimes hard to find, but I've seen several cases of yogis levitating. I saw a case from a guy in Japan, a guy in Tibet, a guy in India. I put some of this evidence in my YouTube video. I wasn't able to get the actual videos on there, but there are some really interesting photographs. There's a guy in Japan, Yogi Narus, who has been photographed a half dozen times in a state of levitation. And
I'm very, you know, evidence oriented. I mean, like, the whole concept of seeing is believing. So for me, you know, being able to see this footage or seeing these kinds of pictures, I think is very important when it comes to things like this.
I totally agree. You know, I came into this field a complete skeptic. I hated UFOs.
Really?
I was repulsed. Like, don't tell me you think you saw a UFO. You're an idiot. That was my attitude, because I was very science-based. I know how far away the stars are, and they're very, very far away. And from a scientific viewpoint, it just didn't seem possible to me that we could be being visited. But I had a series of false assumptions and found out that people within my family, my friends, my coworkers, people I loved and trusted, who I knew weren't lying to me, were having experiences. So I came very skeptical. It was a very, very difficult adjustment. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it 35 years later. And it all ironically made me even more skeptical because I had to readjust my whole worldview. I had to question everything.
Like, yeah, your paradigm got shifted completely on that. And it's not easy when you're trying to bring in things with not a lot of evidence, with science-based evidence, and trying to wrap our brains on how they're able to travel almost instantaneously when here on Earth, we barely even go faster than light travel, if that.
Exactly. Yeah, it absolutely shifted my paradigm in such a profound way that it's hard for me to even describe. And I have, you know, I am all about the evidence. And if you don't believe in UFOs, I'm just going to say it bluntly. You haven't done your homework because the evidence is there. It's not just people's stories. And eyewitness testimony is a form of evidence, certainly, but we have landing trace cases. There are radar return cases, radar visual cases. There is medical evidence, which we just briefly touched on, but there are healing and injury cases, a lot of them. There are, in fact, implant removal cases. There's animal effect cases, electromagnetic cases, all kinds of physical evidence. Angel hair, it's this weird substance that UFOs sometimes eject. That's physical evidence. We have metal fragments.
Can you go into that a little bit? What is angel hair?
Oh, it's so interesting. There's just a smattering of cases like this because we have quite literally 100,000 UFO sightings on record. I mean, a lot, probably closer to 1 million. And in a small number of these cases, just a few hundred really on record. I'm sure you could find more if you really dug deep, but I did, and there's not a lot. And angel hair is this sort of cotton candy-like substance, sort of like spider webs, which is ejected from UFOs. And there are some very famous cases. I covered some in my book, Schoolyard UFO Encounters, where UFOs hover over schools. That's another topic. But one occurred at this Jerome Elementary School in Marysville, Ohio. And it's an astonishing case where these UFOs ejected this substance right over the playground and covered it with this weird substance. Generally speaking, it dissolves very quickly. And in fact, as soon as you touch it, it will sort of jump up and dissolve, just sublime into the atmosphere. But there was so much of it in this case, they were able to collect samples and study it. They sent it off to the local Lockbourne Air Force Base, who refused to release their data on it. But another very similar case occurred 1 year later at Whitsitt Elementary School in North Carolina. Same thing, covered the playground. And they were gathered samples and sent it off to Burlington Scientific Labs, who could not identify it other than as some sort of biological substance. And they thought, well, maybe it's spider webs. We don't think so, but you should contact a biologist who specializes in this area and ask them. So they did. And the biologist said, well, no, this is absolutely not spider webs. And if you're describing that amount of substance, which, you know, covered the playground, there would be evidence of spiders. And there wasn't. So we don't know what this is, but it has been chemically analyzed. And it's got some weird things in it, like aluminum. It's got boron in it, which isn't a super common substance. But what's interesting about boron is this is something that's used to shield nuclear reactors. So thinking, maybe there is a connection there. I don't know. It's a very strange substance that we don't quite know what it is, but as near as I can tell, it is just sort of like UFO exhaust, a byproduct of their engines.
Just merely a byproduct. That's it. No other purpose based on any kind of theories or conspiracies?
There are other theories. Some people thought it's being intentionally emitted to perhaps affect the atmosphere or witnesses, but there's no good evidence of that because it seems to be fairly random. I don't know. In the schoolyard cases, I thought, are they putting on a show here? Are they ejecting this on purpose? Because there is this sort of weird behavior with UFOs to put on a little show, a publicity stunt, a display is what UFO researchers call it. Generally speaking, UFOs are very evasive. They don't want to be seen. That's just not always the case. Sometimes they absolutely want to be seen. Like the Phoenix Lights, 1994, in March, this huge object flies over Phoenix and was seen by thousands. This is clearly a deliberate event. So sometimes they do this. They are, in essence, conducting what I think is a vigorous publicity campaign, announcing their presence in a usually subtle way, you know, to small groups of people, one or two, but sometimes large groups, trying to get the word out without actually, you know, causing huge waves in society.
So then why do you think they're showing themselves in front of children, like these schools that you document?
Yeah, this was very interesting to me and actually quite shocked me. There's a very famous case in Africa, actually, in Zimbabwe, at Ariel Elementary School in Rua, Zimbabwe, where a UFO hovered over the school, landed, beings came out and actually spoke with some of the children. I thought, wow, this is an interesting case. And I instantly remembered another that took place in Wales, pretty much the same thing, Broadhaven Elementary School. And then I knew of another, which occurred at Crestview Elementary School in Opa-locka, Florida, 1 year later. And then, of course, there's a very famous case in Australia, Westall High School, Melbourne, where a UFO landed next to the school again. I'm like, what is going on here? I should look into this. And I found 100 cases, Christina, 100 in all over the world, all across Europe, England, Canada, across the US, South America, Australia. I mean, you name it. And half of the cases are elementary schools.
Wow.
And that's when I started like, okay, I think I know what's going on here. I think they're showing themselves to children, and particularly the youngest of our children, because children are
sponges.
Yeah, they are very much open to this. Most of these kids have never heard of the term UFO. They're not discriminatory. You know, they're not fear-based in their thinking yet. They don't, run away just because something's a little different.
Exactly. Welcome back to the second half of the show. I'm here with Preston Dennett, prolific writer, author, and investigator of UFOs and many related phenomenon. Preston, please go ahead and finish your story about these elementary schools.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And what I would say, sort of just to wrap it up, is that this is absolutely a thing. UFOs are targeting schools. This is not like, kids are out in the playground and they just happen to see something. No, because these objects are coming from, way up high or from the horizon, and they come towards the school, targeting it directly, and stop above the school. These are not normal sightings. The average sighting is sort of an anomalous light at night. It's very brief. It may circle around, hover, dart off, and it's over. In these schoolyard cases, they come right for the school and they hover very low. They are typically within 100 feet, 50 feet, and land in 30% of the cases. Land or humanoids are seen. So this is clearly deliberate. These are long-lasting cases. These are daylight cases, which is unusual. Most UFO sightings are at night, not with these schoolyard cases. So this is clearly part of the ETs. I'm speculating here, but I think the cases speak for themselves. I think this is clearly part of their publicity campaign. They are announcing their presence in a very clever way. They're doing it to children, and children are often not taken too seriously. But the effect has been tremendous because none of these kids have ever retracted their story. This is something they remember very vividly. And it has caused, I think, a really strong belief in UFOs, certainly among the younger generations. So I think it's been very effective. It's a very clever way to announce your presence without necessarily, causing panic among the adult population.
Smart. That's smart. Let's change gears a little bit. Over the years, you have repeatedly kept up your research into subjects of transmedium objects, UFOs that can also be USOs. Now, because of the exposure via witness testimonies of U.S. naval pilots and those aboard ships in the Nimitz carrier strike group, this is something that has grabbed the imagination of the public. Given the amount of research that you have done, what conclusions have you come to about these objects? Like, what's the deal with ocean activity?
I started getting accounts of USOs, unidentified submersible objects, very early on in my research. And I didn't make much of it at first. There's not a whole lot of information about this. And when I wrote a book about UFOs over California, I included a chapter of just USOs, because I had collected a bunch of cases off the Southern California coast. And that's how my research into USOs kind of started and snowballed. and ended up going on the History Channel and doing a show with them, Deep Sea UFOs, and started getting a flood of cases. And people started coming to me because there's very little information about USOs. There hasn't been a lot of research into it until recently. And what I've learned is that our oceans, for that matter, our lakes and rivers, are filled with USOs, sometimes in large numbers. Off the Southern California coast here, I have cases involving not, you know, one or two objects, or even 10 or 20, but there's quite a few involving 10 or 20. But I have some cases involving hundreds. I have three cases at least involving over 100 objects coming up out of the water. That's a lot. So I think what we're looking at here is that these objects have the technology to fly at high speed from the air into the water. They must have some sort of a force field around them, because anything we have would smash to smithereens, would break up in a million bits. The G-forces alone would, you know, turn any pilot into jelly. So they have a really advanced technology. And I think the reason they're doing this, and again, I'm just speculating here, is because they can. They can go down there and hide out, and we don't have access to them. We can't go down there into any great depth, certainly. So I'm guessing they're probably down there in pretty large numbers and hanging out and doing their thing. And when they need to come up and, you know, do a little show or take someone on board to do what they ever do, which is usually healing them or warning them about upcoming environmental disaster or nuclear proliferation, or showing them the engine room and asking, why do you use fossil fuels, or trying to spiritually wake them up. I mean, these are their agendas, but they're hiding out. And I've got cases in very small lakes, rivers, but all over the world in our oceans.
And you wrote a book back in 2018 about undersea alien bases. You know, I myself often muse about the possibility of outposts deep in the oceans, possibly alien bases that dispatch scientific research craft to observe our development. You know what I mean? What more have you learned since writing that particular book, and what conclusions have you come to?
Yeah, that book was because I'd collected so much evidence that it was really pointing towards the possibility, well, I'll say probability of some sort of base down there. And I kind of started charting all of the cases that I had on this map. I'm like, wow, they're really clustered here in the Santa Catalina, San Pedro Channel. There's something going on here, because this is a pretty sharply defined area. And this is, you know, where the Navy has been having some problems with these UFOs. And I thought, well, okay, you know, why in this area? Why for so long? I mean, I've got cases going down to the 1920s and still occurring today. I mean, there's cases from 2021. I appeared on Josh Gates's show, Expedition X, and they interviewed me about this area because they wanted to try and record some USO activity. And they did. I was on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, of all shows. They live in Malibu. They called
down.
You were? I was. Yeah.
No.
Last thing I ever expected was to be on that show. But they were very sweet, really nice people. And I wanted to know how to call down a UFO. And I showed them the methods, meditation, and so forth. And they did. They recorded it. This is in the same area. But what I've learned is that, yeah, I think there possibly is a base. Because the reason I say that is because I plotted these things on a map, right? I'm like, they're really clustered here in this one area. And it was shortly after that that other researchers came out with these images underwater in off the coast of Malibu in Southern California, which shows this weird, it's called the Malibu Anomaly, is what it's come to be known as. And it's this weird sort of structure-looking thing. And, you know, debunker skeptics will say, this is just, you know, a natural formation. But it looks like it's got pillars, columns. It looks like it has a really flat top. It looks like it's got a tunnel in some of these Google images. Not all, but some. So I'm a bit on the fence about it, other than the fact that, wow, I kind of predicted this was where the base would be. And lo and behold, here's this weird anomaly. And what I found out after this book was published was one of the guys I had talked to, actually he's famous, Merrill Fankhauser. He wrote that song Wipeout. And he was part of this whole investigation because he knew people who had seen activity. And he contacted me after the book came out. He says, I have to tell you something really interesting. He was in Las Vegas when he was talking to a Native American elder. The Gabrielano and Chumash Indians have lived in this area for thousands of years. And this elder was talking to him, and they started talking about the UFOs and USOs off the coast, which led to this Malibu anomaly, this weird structure. And this Native American elder told Merrill Fankhauser, he said, yeah, we are aware of this. We have oral traditions of this. We know about it. It's been there for as long as we remember. And in fact, according to our oral tradition, the level of the ocean used to be much lower. And our peoples would actually go out on the edge of this thing and fish off of the edge of it. And we didn't make it. We did not construct it. And I thought, oh, so the implication was that this was constructed. I don't know. But there's some pretty good arguments that there is some sort of base down there. Because the fact is, I've talked to people who've been taken from this area by UFOs and were not taken into, you know, a small rounded room, like often people describe, but into an underground area with vast chambers and stone walls and what appears could very well be this undersea base. I've got like four cases of that.
Of the same base or in different locations around the globe?
No, all of these cases are in the same area. One lady was taken from Malibu off the coast, another guy from Avalon Harbor on Catalina, another from the Channel Islands area. So all from the same general area. But there are reports of other undersea bases around the world. And for that matter, underground bases. Mount Shasta has got some very compelling accounts. Not just one or two, over a dozen.
Yeah, they do. I did some research into it, and it is incredibly shocking. And there's some theories saying that there is an underground base under Mount Shasta as well. But what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that there's an underground base there?
I think there might be. I actually had my own UFO sighting there with my brother and sister-in-law. It was one of my first sightings. My brother saw it first. He's like, I saw a light. No, grab the flashlight. We were hoping to see a UFO, and we brought this really powerful flashlight. Like, maybe we can communicate with it. This was starting to become a thing in the UFO field. And we flashed our light at this thing, and this thing flashed back. I couldn't believe it.
When was this?
This was 1992. April 1992. I believe that's right. Yeah. And could have been 93. But around that time. And I thought, wow, you know, I've taken a bunch of astronomy courses. I was all about astronomy. And I could see instantly this wasn't a plane. It wasn't a balloon. It wasn't a satellite, a shooting star, you know, helicopter. You know, when you see something,
you go through it all. Got to check them all off.
Yeah, you're looking at it like, because you don't want to jump to UFO. You don't. People are very resistant, generally speaking, to admit that they're seeing something strange because it's disconcerting a little bit. Actually, I thought it was exciting. and we flashed twice, and this thing flashed twice back. So there was communication there. And that was enough for me to be like, oh my God, this is for real. This is absolutely for real. And I've done that sort of thing after that, a number of times. These are called CE5s, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, or Human Initiated Contact. There's a huge movement going on right now. And just one last thing with CE5s and disclosure, I think that might be where disclosure ultimately comes from, is experiencers, the people who do a CE5 event and basically call down UFOs and are able to record it. So that's already happened a number of times. But one of these days, it's going to happen in a big way. I certainly hope so.
I'm really happy that you brought up CE5 because I was going to ask you some questions on that. One of them being, for those that have had experiences doing CE5, why do you think it works for them? Why do you think that these entities are coming down because they're called upon, even though that they're probably a lot more intelligent than we are?
Yeah, it's really quite strange. Like I said, ETs, I think, do have an agenda to sort of announce their presence. I think they're really wanting people to contact them. They want us to meet them halfway, so to speak. I can only speculate, and I hate to speculate in this field. I kind of like to stick to the facts.
But it's hard not to.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many rabbit holes in this field that you can go right down it and you end up in, you know, Wonderland. So you want to be really careful. But yeah, just looking at the cases from a facts standpoint, it's clear that this method works. It's absolutely clear that these UFOs are showing themselves intentionally and that they're aware of it. And I've come to, it's my assessment, certainly, that when someone sees a UFO, it is by and large an intentional event. The UFOs are showing themselves on purpose and know they are being observed, particularly if it's at all close in any way. But it's hard to say. I think this is still a cutting-edge area. There's a lot of room for research in this field. It's still relatively new. Yes, UFOs have been around for millennia. I mean, we know this from hieroglyphs and petroglyphs and cave paintings and medieval wood carvings and Renaissance paintings. We know they've been around forever. But since 1947, which coincides exactly with the atomic age, no coincidence there. A lot of researchers have pointed this out. That's what's drawn them in large numbers. And they've been very much watching us very closely since then. And what's going on is unprecedented in human history.
And exciting.
They're watching really us very closely and trying to reach out to us.
Yeah, they are. And you grew up in Topanga Canyon. Did I say it right? Topanga?
Yep.
I sound like a, like, never mind. Okay, so this is, just, I feel like I'm saying it wrong with an accent. But so this is in Southern California. And in 1999, you published a book called UFOs Over Topanga Canyon. Can you elaborate on that for viewers who haven't read your book? And is this still a hot spot to see UFO activity in the skies today?
It certainly is. That's where I grew up and ironically never saw anything. And I was out there, you know, collecting tadpoles and camping out late at night and climbing trees. It's a beautiful area. It's got a very large state park there. So a lot of wilderness there. It's a small community. When I grew up, it was about 8,000 people. It's a bit larger now, but still very rural.
That's small.
And yeah, this is sort of sandwiched in the Santa Monica Mountains, next to Malibu and Santa Monica. Beautiful area. And yes, it's got a lot of UFO activity, I found out. When I found out that some of my family and friends and coworkers had had sightings, a number of them were in Topanga. And I ended up writing an article for the local newspaper. And the editor loved it. He put it on the cover. I was shocked, of the local newspaper.
What year was this?
That would be 1989.
And it was on the front page?
Yeah, that was my second article. You mentioned the first. I'm surprised you dug that up. No one's ever dug that up before. I really
admire your work, Justin. Honestly, I do. So I looked into it.
That's really cool. I love that. But that was my second article, and it got the cover. And it was just, 3 years later, 1992. Because that article was actually 1989, 1990, right there in the sort of December, January time period. And the editor of the newspaper, Colin Penno, calls me up one day and said that there's been a wave of sightings over Topanga. And I'm like, what? And he says, yeah, I have a police tape. It was snuck out. Would you like to listen to it? And I'm like, are you kidding? And it was four people who had called the local police station to report UFOs. And he says, can you investigate? And I said, sure. And I found a bunch of other cases because I knew a lot of people in this area. I had just moved out a year before this incident, or a year after. Yeah, it was a year before this incident. But I still knew a lot of people, and I started collecting cases. And it was my sister-in-law who was like, no, you have like 100 cases here. You should write a book. I'm like, oh, you know, I never even thought of that. Maybe you're right. Because there was a wave of sightings which went on from 1992 to 94 that was huge.
Really?
These objects were not only being sighted by many different people, but were chasing cars down the road, were landing, were abducting people, were coming in and out of the water. But the real night was June 14th, 1992. That's when the people called the police, a bunch of people. One car was chased down the road. Another was chased down the road and lifted up. Another was, couple were in their house and a UFO hovered right over their house and lit up the entire interior. It woke them up. They went running outside and this huge object was right over their house. Not a plane, not a helicopter. It had a low buzzing noise. And I started to collect more and more cases. From that single night, I found about 20 or 30 witnesses in separate locations throughout the canyon who saw all this activity. So incredible confirmation that something very, very unusual was going on June 14th, 1992. And sort of built the book around that one night. But I found cases going back to 1930s, all the way up. Well, it's still going on. It's a great place to see UFOs.
Well, I know where I'm going to stop by next when I hit California. Go right there.
I'm telling you, that's a great place.
And while we're on the topic about this state, let's talk about crash retrievals. I saw that one of the videos you feature in your YouTube channel, you talk about this, but you also wrote a book about UFOs over California as a whole. So what can you tell us about these kinds of crash retrievals?
Yeah, of course, everyone's heard of Roswell, I think. A very famous incident in Roswell, New Mexico, 1947. And I think a lot of people are under the impression that this sort of thing is very rare. And perhaps it is, in quotes, rare, but not nearly as rare as you might think. There are several well-known incidents. There's another one in New Mexico, the Aztec UFO crash. There's another one in Arizona that's fairly well-known. It goes by the Paradise Valley crash. Another one in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, 1965. I started to look into it because when I wrote UFOs Over California, which was one of actually many books I've written on various states, such as New Mexico, New York, Nevada, Colorado, and Arizona, I found a bunch of cases in California alone, and I found them in every single state I covered. So my point is UFO crashes are not nearly as rare as you might think. There were dozens in New Mexico, but several in all these other states. There was a crash outside of Edwards Air Force Base. There's a number of reports of UFOs being held at Norton Air Force Base. So there's another one up in Northern California very early where this farmer came upon this craft in his field. Air Force showed up, were able to lift it, you know, with just a few men, and put it onto a flatbed truck, covered it with a tarp, and shipped it off. This is what usually happens. The Air Force will come rushing in and take these objects away. But it's shocking how many of these cases there are. Somewhere in the military, we have absolute 100% conclusive proof of the reality of UFOs. And this is why I think the military is being so disingenuous when they say, oh, we think it might be extraterrestrial, but we have no evidence of it. I'm like, wait, what? No evidence? What about these pilots who are seeing metallic craft moving at thousands of miles per hour that are appearing on radar, that are turning at right angles and accelerating? That's evidence. That's evidence of a technology, not a balloon, not a radar echo. So for them to say no evidence is so disingenuous when really places like Area 51 in Nevada, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, Edwards Air Force Base in Victorville, California. These are three of the main spots where they're neck deep in this stuff. They're collecting this hardware. I have firsthand cases from whistleblowers myself that I've talked to. There's one case, if I may mention briefly.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, this gentleman contacted me, and I was very honored because he was actually in the hospital on his deathbed. This is a deathbed confession. And this is, very profound and touching. And there's a number of these in the field where people, whistleblowers, just feel compelled to get this information out before they pass away. And this gentleman was a subcontractor for the military. He was a civilian, but did a lot of work for military bases and did some work at Edwards Air Force Base. And as soon as he said Edwards, I thought, oh no, because I'd studied Edwards and it's a UFO magnet. There's nothing with UFOs that hasn't happened there. They've had activity since 1947. I mean, I could go on and on about Edwards. I could talk for 2 hours about Edwards. I'm not kidding.
What state is that in?
That's in Southern California. And so he was taken to work at Edwards to do some contracting work, and was walking by a hangar with his employee, this open hangar. And he looks in through the window because he heard this deep thrumming noise, like almost echoing in his chest, and looks over in this hangar and gets a real shock because there's a UFO inside. Tiny little thing. It was like the size of a little Honda Accord, a little sports car, he said, but shiny silver, no portholes. It looked like chrome. And it's floating. It was floating. But there were, you know, cables attached to it. And he turns to his employer and says, "What the heck is that?" And his employer gets all pale and wide-eyed and said, "Shh, you know, don't talk, shh," and wouldn't talk about it and absolutely refused to talk about it for over a year. But then one day, you know, he finished the job and that was it. And the employer wouldn't talk. Well, a year later, the employer calls him back and says, "I need you to do a job for me." And the guy I interviewed says, "No, not doing it unless you tell me what we saw." And so they got into a little bit of an argument about it and ended up having lunch and a few beers. And the guy spilled the beans. Said,
"Always
okay."
With the alcohol.
Right? And what he said was that, no, this wasn't a UFO. This was not a crashed UFO. But what it was reverse engineered from ET technology. It was a craft that used ET technology and involved counter-rotating magnets, which didn't surprise me a bit, because this is what the ETs will often tell people. Oh, we use electromagnetism to pilot our craft. And this craft, according to this military guy, used counter-rotating magnets to create a sort of a gravity field on the outside of the craft, like a little, not a black hole, but along those lines, which would propel the craft in that direction. But totally silent, did not use propellants. This was, in essence, a UFO, but it was our own.
And what year was this? When this happened, but not when he gave the confession, but when he saw this?
Late 70s.
Wow, yeah. In the 70s, and I already had this kind of technology. That's insane.
Yeah, all the technology we see is old. A lot, the technology that's being held by our military is far, far in advance. I've gotten told this by a number of people. Shoot, this guy came in my office where I work. You know, I do bookkeeping. I've worked full time through all these years of UFO research until just recently. I'm now part time. But this guy came and worked at our office. He was in the Army. He's like, "Oh my gosh, you're not going to believe the technology they showed me." And he didn't even have a top secret clearance. But he says the stuff that they have just blew his mind.
Well, that hour flew by. I want to thank Preston so much for joining me for this week's show. It's been awesome and so much great information. We're going to continue this Q&A from my Patreon supporters for about another 15 minutes. And that's just one of the perks of many that are available to you if you decide to support me, this channel, and my work. Preston, can you tell the viewers where they can find you on the internet, social media, and where they can find copies of your books online?
Yeah, thanks, Christina. I appreciate it. I do have a website. I think if you just use the search engine on my name, it should take you right there. But the actual address is prestondennett.weebly.com. I'm also on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I have a YouTube channel. Always love hearing from people. You can contact me through my website if you know you have a comment or a question or a story you'd like to share. I think this is a very important subject. You may not believe in UFOs, but it's going to change the world at some point when all this gets pushed into the mainstream. And it's starting right now.
It's starting happening. Like a storm.
Yeah, it's exciting times.
Oh, it is exciting to be alive. And I will place all of his links in the description box below. So that was awesome. I want to thank again all of my Patreon supporters. I could not do this without your kind support. Everyone, please take care. Have a great weekend. And as always, keep your eyes on the skies.